Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, in for Steve Kraske. In the 1920s, comic books developed as a form of fantasy, and then as a source of escapism during the Great Depression. The superheroes they featured fought against fascism in the 40s and the Red Menace in the 50s. In later years, they took on major social issues facing America. And today, we'll be exploring how the comics reflect and react to their times. Joining us for this conversation are Larry Tai. He's the author of Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Larry also runs the Health Coverage Fellowship, which assists the media in improving coverage of critical healthcare issues. Larry, thanks for being here today.
Great to be with you.
And joining us by phone is Michael Uslan. He's made his life Batman. He's served as the executive producer for the Dark Knight trilogy of Batman movies. He's also the executive producer of the upcoming Batman versus Superman film, which should be out sometime next year, perhaps. And he joins us by phone. He also wrote the memoir, The Boy Who Loved Superman. Michael, welcome to Up to Date.
Thanks so much, Matthew.
And so let's just start right at the beginning. You know, the men behind the mask and the men behind the mask behind and the pens and stories. Who were the men who gave birth to Superman and Batman? Larry, let's start with you and Superman.
Sure. There were two Jewish kids named Siegel and Schuster in a neighborhood of Cleveland, Ohio that was 70% Jewish, and they gave birth to him in the 1930s. At a time when America sure could have used a hero. And they gave birth to him, we now know, having seen Jerry Siegel's unpublished memoir, that basically Jerry was a kid who went out on the playground every day and was bullied. He was a little bit too short, a little bit too fat, wore glasses that looked more like Coke bottles and glasses, and he needed a hero to help him take on those bullies, and he created a character called the Superman.
Was it a similar story for Batman, Michael?
In a lot of ways, it was. Batman was originally created by Bob Kane, nay Bob Kahn, who was a teenager back in 1939, along with Bill Finger. And what they crafted was in reaction to Superman. They had the second superhero. And rather than go with another superpowered guy, the angle they brought to the table was, well, how about a guy with no superpowers, but somebody who's real, who perhaps his greatest superpower is his humanity? And I think that's one of the reasons over the decades, and now Batman is celebrating his 75th anniversary, so many people around the world, transcending borders and cultures, can identify with this character. He just feels real to all of us.
It's interesting you mentioned that he feels real, because it's sometimes hard to remember that both these superheroes were inventions. But then again, they didn't necessarily come out of nothingness. Larry, where did the creators go to find their inspiration for Superman? And then Michael, Batman as well, after Larry finishes.
So what they tell us is that they essentially looked in the mirror, and that was where they got their images for the characters. Joe Schuster actually said when he was trying to draw Superman, he would look in the mirror, and either he had terrible eyesight or he had a great imagination, because he didn't look a whole lot like his character. Jerry Siegel thought that deep within himself and deep within everybody who was reading about the Superman character, if the girls on the playground were smart enough to see beyond the schlubby-looking Jerry Siegel, they would see that there was a superhero buried there. And I think that's part of the key why he's lasted for 75 years and counting.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, with Batman?
Well, Batman's primary source material was the old pulp magazines, the dime novels, very specifically The Shadow, mm-hmm. A direct ancestor to Batman. And again, you have the dual identity, the wealthy man about town who channels his wealth for noble pro-social purposes. And with Batman, it focuses on an origin story that is so primal, everyone seems to be able to relate to it, of a young boy, a victim of crime, who actually sees his parents murdered before his eyes. And at that moment, in sacrificing his childhood, makes a commitment in the belief that one person can make a difference in the world, that he will get the guy who did this, he will get all the bad guys, even if he has to walk through hell for the rest of his life in order to do it. A lot of that comes from everyone from Zorro to the Shadow to the Bat and to so many of those pulp heroes.
Mm. And the business that kind of took these heroes and made them something that, you know, we all now know about, the comic books, they were a relatively new invention in the 1930s. Isn't that correct, Michael?
Absolutely. The comics first started in the mid-1930s, and originally they were reprints in booklet form of comic strips that you would find in the newspaper. But then, running out of material and finding it very expensive to license some of this material, some of the new publishers who jumped on the bandwagon of this new hot, what they thought might be a fad, might be a trend, they started to develop their own original material. And that's what gave the opportunities for so many of these teenagers and young men, Jewish artists and writers who were unable to get a job working on Madison Avenue, working in the publishing business at a time when there was a lot of bigotry. And this was an industry that pretty much nobody wanted. Everybody looked down their nose at it. And it really is very similar, in effect, to the movie business. Same kind of thing happened that opened up opportunities for a lot of people who couldn't get their niche, couldn't get their foot in the door. So, the 30s were the birth of the comic books, and the birth of the superhero specifically was 1938 with Superman.
And it's kind of interesting, with the comic book, like, all of a sudden, kids had kind of their own private world, right? In essence, they could purchase something and you know, bring it to their home, but it was like, it was theirs. It wasn't like a part of the newspaper that they had to like vie for from you know, an older family member. And so there was a lot of ownership. And did that kind of influence how popular the superheroes became, Larry?
Yes, it was absolutely a language and characters that kids thought were entirely their own world. And you've got to remember that the people who were giving them these characters were not a whole lot older than they were. And I think that was part of the key, that Jerry and Joe and Batman's creators really understood the language of kids because that was their language. And they were as surprised as anybody. Jerry and Joe basically tried to sell Superman to everybody out there, and what they were sending in ended up in the trash can. And in 1938, when finally they found an owner who was willing to give this a chance, everybody looks back and says they sold the rights to Superman in perpetuity in every medium for the grand total to be divided between the two of them of $130. And that's seen as the original sin or the ultimate ripoff. And yet, I think they would have paid somebody $130. They were so anxious to see their characters in print, and they did. And it took off almost from the very beginning.
And their estates would be fighting for the copyright for Superman through his Larry's passing, correct?
Right. Through the last 75 years, Jerry and Joe, even beyond their death, they would perpetually file a lawsuit, hold up their right hand when they lost a lawsuit and say, we will never file another one, take us back, and then get angry again. And on their deathbed, supposedly, Jerry said that he wanted this lawsuit to continue, and it is continuing to this day. It's actually now decided against them all the way through the federal appeals court, and it's now a question of whether they will appeal his heirs to the Supreme Court to try to get back the rights.
Superman in the halls of justice. But let's take a little step back from those legal quandaries they find themselves in. And let's talk a little bit about the world of the 1930s that they came into. When Batman came into existence, there was kind of this idealistic and Superman. They were kind of just like fighting petty crime, right? But they kind of matured and began to take on organized crime. Michael, how did they kind of mature through the 1930s and evolve?
Well, the first thing you have to remember is that you have to set it in the context of those times. It was the Depression. It was an era of a lot of gangsters, famous gangsters, which also influenced the Warner Brothers movies and so many other movies. It wasn't just comics. It was every kind of media that was out there in the pop culture. And set in the 1930s, it was a time of gangdom. It was a time of political corruption. Not saying today isn't, but it was reflective of what was happening at that particular moment. The transition began to occur around about 1941 when two things started to happen. Number one is the advent of the supervillain. In Batman Comics number one, in the spring of 1940, that issue introduced the Joker, whom I claim is the greatest supervillain ever created in the history of comics, and the Catwoman. And that took the entire superhero level to a whole new place and presented villains who really were capable of standing up to the powers and abilities of those heroes. And I subscribe to the Stan Lee theory, which is that ultimately the superheroes are defined by their supervillains, and those who have the best supervillains last the longest and have become the most popular. The other thing I want to point out is that, again, starting around 1941, for example, Captain America comics number one, 9 months before World War II began for us, had Captain America slugging Adolf Hitler on the cover, as rendered by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. So you also had creeping in the nationalistic America leading into World War II, when the villains would also turn from gangdom to the Nazis and Imperial Japan.
Do we see a similar trajectory with Superman, Larry?
We do. So in the 1930s, when Superman was created, the great bugaboo out there was the Great Depression, and Superman was out there as a butt-kicking New Deal liberal, like the guy in the White House, taking on everybody from slumlords to wife-beaters. In the 40s, America was going to war, and Superman helped take us to war. In the 50s, we were looking for a red under every bed, and so was Superman. Through the eras, Superman evolved, taking on not just fantasy, but real-world kinds of villains that had a certain resonance. And we actually see 6 months ago in a Superman comic book, Superman did something shocking, which was quit the Daily Planet to become a blogger. And that was one more way that his writers were trying to make him contemporary and believable.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that he was, you know, essentially engaging in politics. Mm-hmm. You know, he was pro-New Deal. You know, how much of that was just the writers and how – like and why did people feel the need to communicate these kind of, you know, political issues to children?
Yes. So I think they were just trying to take on a sense of their times, and that's why his politics changed to the point where when Ronald Reagan was in office and that was the big thing, Superman's hair got a bit shorter and his politics turned a little bit rightward. And I think it was trying to make him contemporary, but also trying to keep sort of overt politics out of it. Superman was one of the last people to get involved with anything from the peace movement to racial justice to other things. He was taking on the tenor of his times, but he was staying away often from controversial issues, with one big exception, which was that Superman actually took on the Ku Klux Klan and some scary forces in American society before most of America was ready to do it. But he did that on his radio show.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3 FM, and I'm Matthew Law Middleton. We're talking with Larry Tai. He's the author of Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, and Michael Uslan. He's the executive producer of the Dark Knight trilogy. He's also written a book on the subject called, The Boy Who Loved Batman. And I want to get our listeners involved here and to this conversation. If you remember something from the comics that was addressing a critical social issue and have a comment or question, you can call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us. Our address is uptodate@kcur.org. And so when World War II broke out, there was this incredible mobilization politically, socially, economically. We had to get an entire populace essentially into the war movement. And the superheroes kind of led the charge. Michael, did Batman run off to Europe or to the Pacific to go fight the Axis powers?
No, he did not. The rationale behind that came from editorial policy at DC Comics. They did not want to do anything that would indicate to any of their readers, and the bulk of those readers, by the way, were split between kids and servicemen. They did not want to indicate that their superheroes were more superheroic than America's servicemen. They didn't want to show Superman and Batman going over and mopping up the Nazis in an hour. They didn't want to take anything away from our morale and for being supportive of the servicemen. So most of the superheroes in that era, at least from DC, concentrated on the domestic issues. And in a lot of cases, that was fifth columnists, the Bund, spies, saboteurs, and that was really the focus of it. Also, they used them for propaganda purposes. Many of the comic book companies actually had contracts with the government and did all kinds of pro-government programs for, during World War II, everything from pushing the sale of stamps and pushing the sale of bonds to developing victory gardens. And there are a number of comic book covers, especially those from World's Finest Comics, which teamed up Superman and Batman, where you could see those heroes planting a victory garden or selling bonds and stamps.
Larry, again, to get back to this question, you know, why, if it was servicemen who are already engaged in war and children who you know, can't necessarily go out and buy an expensive bond, you know, what was the feeling or the thought behind trying to, you know, drum up this support among those populations?
Sure. So what Michael said is exactly right. They were very smart in not sending them off to war, partly because it would offend the troops, but partly it turned out, and it was a brilliant marketing strategy, after the war, when America wanted to forget about the war and sort of move ahead with a new world, neither Superman nor Batman were so closely identified with that, it was easy for them to sort of pick back up. But they did something quite brilliant, I think, with Superman, and I presume with Batman as well, which is they often included that comic book in the ration kits that went overseas when they were sending off to the troops. And it wasn't just to give them something to read. It was also to remind them, I think what the troops were fighting for was to come back and recapture their innocence in a world at peace. And there was no better symbol of recapturing youth than recapturing the ability to read a comic book and think about fantasy worlds like that rather than fighting for the country.
Mm. And when we look back at some of these comics, you know, we definitely find the depictions of Nazis and the Japanese were at very times dehumanizing. How were those creative choices? How did they come up? Or was it even something they probably even talked about or debated? And you know, looking back, does the comic industry kind of, you know, regret some of the choices they made about that? Larry?
Sure. I think that they were quite good at being balanced. On the one hand, clearly Hitler and at the beginning Stalin were the enemies, and Superman went out there in a very early issue before America was even at war and sort of dragged them to the court of justice and made them into the bad guys. But I think that having fantasy characters as enemies during the war also was a way of keeping the country realizing that there was another world out there that we couldn't become so absorbed in the war, and that fantasy world and escapism was something we might have needed then more than ever.
Mm-hmm. And then we had the birth of the atomic age, and you know, it's interesting because like that helped, you know, end the war pretty quickly, but it also introduced this brand new kind of terror about, you know, a cataclysmic event of the entire world falling apart. Michael, how did the comic book industry kind of deal with the advent of this kind of scary and powerful technology?
Well, it really first appeared in pages of Superman and Captain Marvel, some of the strongest superheroes that the comics had. All of a sudden, there was this incredible power, this incredible force that seemed even bigger than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And that was scary. You know, I was a kid growing up in the 50s where we had our duck and cover commercials on TV. And we had our air raid drills in school where we got under our little tiny wooden desks and were told to, you know, when we saw the flash, to duck our heads as if our little desks would protect us from the 10,000-degree heat that was arriving. But those were the times. There was a lot of fear, and the superheroes were there for escapism to give us an outlet for that fear. And also, it was a transition period. Post-World War II, a lot of the superheroes went out of business. There wasn't that intrinsic need for the great American hero so much at this point. And during that time period, as the superhero genre faded greatly, other genres came in, one of which were called war comics, and dealt with the adventures of soldiers from primarily World War II, but also the Korean War. And American comic book readers began to look to this new brand of hero.
And so in, you know, which one of these, why was there this sudden decline in all the, in the plethora of superheroes that, that had come onto the scene? Was it just the market was saturated, or was it like we had achieved the dream? Michael?
Well, I think it was really a combination. Yes, from a business perspective, there was absolutely a glut on the marketplace. Many, many comic book companies jumped into the success that was taking place during the golden age of World War II, and the newsstands were flooded with titles. So, yes, that is part of the problem. The other thing was, as World War II ended and that need for superheroes began to wane, because the greatest villain for all the superheroes for those years were the Nazis, and they were no longer the villain of the piece. So that partially, I think, pulled the rug out from under. Also, remember, a lot of superheroes in the golden age of the 1940s were what we call patriotic superheroes. Captain America, the Shield, the Defender, the Patriot. And those that were most ensconced in the American war movement and the American nationalistic movement by the time the late 40s hit, couldn't find an audience anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go to the calls here. We have Carl in Blue Springs. Carl, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you very much.
And
I'm a frequent listener.
Great. And your question or comment today?
In the 70s, Stan Lee published an issue of Spider-Man where he dealt with the issue of drug use without the comic code seal of approval. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know, you know, where exactly did the comic code seal of approval come from, and how did that work out for Stan Lee and the Spider-Man at the time?
Great question, Carl. Larry?
Sure. I think that the comic code came from a lot of the same places that the Red Scare did in those days. It was a lot of people who were looking for relatively facile answers to our social ills, and it was easy to blame rising juvenile delinquency on kids reading comic books. They did very strange surveys where they would ask people in detention centers and elsewhere whether they had read comic books. And the truth is, if you had asked kids anywhere across America, whether they were in the A students or the D students, whether they read comic books, they all did. But it was easy, the way they structured these surveys, to assume that comic books were the source of all this horrible juvenile delinquency out there. That led to everybody from the PTA to various religious groups having a campaign against comic books that struck out not just against the more lurid of them, but against Superman and Batman and all the people. It was partly the standards that the code set, and it's partly when you have a restrictive code like that, everybody is trying to anticipate what might turn out to be bad, and you saw people pulling back in Superman and Batman and lots of comics, and thankfully those heroes had enough residence that they survived the comic book codes, but lots of comics didn't.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, who was sponsoring some of that research? You know, it kind of sounds like they were looking for the cause, you know, and they were just going to find it. Was there actual, like, you know, people who already had preconceived notions about what comic books were doing?
Oh, completely, Matthew. As you know, the witch hunt is always there. Mm-hmm. Society, parents, and I can say this now being one, authorities, administrators, educators, nobody likes to take the blame when things are going bad. They like to find the cause in our society that's making our kids bad. World War II, after World War II, there was a huge post-war rise in juvenile delinquency. And this all really was precipitated by a psychiatrist by the name of Frederick Wortham, who had his own clinic in Brooklyn. And he did exactly what Larry said. And, you know, if you interview 100 juvenile delinquents and they each say, yeah, I've read comic books, and the conclusion then is comic books cause juvenile delinquency, you're pretty stuck. Mm-hmm. There were comic book burnings at the time. If it wasn't for the advent of rock and roll and Elvis Presley, comic books may have gone out of business at that point in time, but the witch hunt just moved to the next target. Suddenly it was rock and roll. It was the hip movements of Elvis Presley that were destroying the youth of America. Later, that became Saturday morning cartoons. Later, that became video games, hip-hop, and rap music. So, you know, it's a constant in our society.
And right before we go to break, I want to get back to Carl's question when he called in, which was about Stan Lee publishing an issue of Spider-Man where he kind of went against the drug cartel or drugs and drug use in America without the seal of approval of the Comic Code Authority. And how I think his question was, how did that play out? Larry, quickly before we go to break.
Sure. I think that by the 70s, when he was talking about this Stan Lee issue, I think the code had lost a lot of its real strength, and that people were taking more chances in publishing things that generally ended up getting by the code.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our look at how comics and comic book heroes respond and to current events and issues. I'm Matthew Law Milton. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. If you missed our conversation, welcome back to Up to Date. And if you missed your conversation on Fred Phelps or the life lessons from a local author, you can find that at kcur.org. And tomorrow on the program, join us for a religious roundtable as we look at how simple objects have significance in multiple faiths. This hour, we're talking about comics. You can hear the music of Hans Zimmer back there from the Dark Knight trilogy. And we're looking at how they deal with current events and issues. Larry Tai is here. He'll be speaking twice today in the metro area. First at the Jewish Community Center, where he'll be speaking at 12:45 on the role of comic books and their play in the fight against fascism. And then later this evening at the Kansas City Central Library at 6:30 on his book Superman. Information on both those events is available at UpToDate at the KCUR webpage. And on the phone, we have Michael Uslan. He's the executive producer of the Dark Knight trilogy movies, as well as the upcoming Batman Superman movie. And his memoir he's written is The Boy Who Loved Superman. So we kind of just left off on the comic book code of the 1950s and the Red Scare. And then we kind of came into this really big, big change in the 1960s and 70s. There was this incredible amount of political and social change. There was a war in Vietnam that was ostensibly to, you know, preserve our freedom. And at home, minority citizens were demanding their rightful equality, which was in direct opposition to the established order. The homeostasis of like the 1950s was shattering. How did comic book heroes interpret right from wrong in these times? Larry, let's start with you.
Sure. So Superman in the 1960s was this wonderful case of escapism, that basically the guy who was controlling the character then was Mort Weisinger, and he was an editor who was pretty conservative in his political views, didn't like a whole lot of the foment going on in America back then, and decided he would avoid it by creating what he called imaginary stories, which I thought was a wonderful term, suggesting somehow that the normal Superman stories weren't imaginary stories. But he was taking us away into fantasy worlds, and that was the era in which Superman seemed least bound to the things going on around him and least relevant if you cared about what was going on in a real world.
And Michael, you mentioned earlier in the program that villains seem to be the thing that kind of defines the hero in some ways. What was happening with some of Batman's villains in the 60s and 70s? Did we see new villains, and did they kind of represent, you know, either the oppression of the time?
Well, Batman had a huge change. You have to remember that in the 60s there was the Batman TV series, which was very campy, and I always felt made a joke out of Batman, which was always an issue for me. And the comic books suffered greatly, the Batman comics in particular, when Batman went off the air on TV. Sales absolutely plummeted to the point Batman was being considered for cancellation as a comic book title. Mm. And they had to save Batman. And a group, which was centered around editor Julia Schwartz, decided to take him back to his darkest early roots and to reinstate that creature of the night who stalks criminals from the shadows. And in transition and reflecting the times, Bruce Wayne closes up his mansion. He moves into Midtown Gotham City with Alfred. Robin is packed off and sent away to college. And the Batmobile is converted to a dark little sports car. And all of a sudden, the Batman, the darker version of Batman, reemerges, and in doing so, finds a brand new audience. Because you have to also understand that in the late 60s and into the 70s, the audience for comic books was getting older. It was appealing to college students, largely opened by Stan Lee and the Marvel Age of superheroes beginning in 1961. So everything about comics was really in flux. Also in the mid to late 60s, you had new blood coming in to write and draw comics, younger people, a new generation, the generation that was enmeshed in social issues of the day, from the Vietnam War to ecology to women's rights to civil rights. So all this was being reflected in that mirror of our society that we call comic books. And in that process, especially for superheroes that dealt more with relevant issues of the day like Green Lantern and Green Arrow, a lot of times the new supervillains were truly personifications or embodiments of social issues, such as pollution. Pollution, in effect, became a great supervillain during that time period. Everything was changing.
Are you saying that I'm not familiar enough with comics? Was there literally a character named Pollution, or was it just, you know, those were some of the nefarious activities that the villains were doing?
That was the activities that the villains did. Mm-hmm. And there was a great picture on the cover of Justice League comics, which teamed up Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and the DC characters, where this villain is just filling the air with dark clouds and the superheroes are gasping for breath. But believe me, they made their point very dramatically.
Let's ask our listeners what they think. How well do comics serve as a mirror of our times? You can tweet us at KCUR. Up to date. That's our handle, KCUR Up to Date on Twitter. And why did Superman get so campy, particularly with the television show? What precipitated that, Michael?
Well, Batman became campy.
Oh, excuse me, because, Batman. Sorry.
Yeah, Batman became campy because the people that were putting the show on were from an older generation, and they were looking for something different to bring to television. And they were doing, actually, literal translations originally of the purple prose and dialogue found in comic books from the 1940s to the early 60s. And they try to capture the feel of it with tilted angles and perspectives to try to feel like comic book panels. And that was a noble experiment. But by the time they started to bring the comic book sound effects to the screen, everything began to go a little bit downhill until we finally wound up with Batman doing the Bat-toosie and spraying giant sharks with bat shark repellent.
Everyone needs a pair of shark repellent in their utility belt. Larry, and what was Superman up to in these decades? You mentioned earlier he took on the Ku Klux Klan, but he also kind of took a back seat on some of the social issues as well.
He definitely did during the 1960s. What he was up to was these superheroes, Batman and Superman, were out there in just about every medium there was. And Superman, from the earliest days, was out leading the way in radio and on television. The 60s were the end of what I thought was the greatest Superman TV the series ever, which was the original one, The Adventures of Superman with George Reeves. And when I went back as a kid, I watched these things and bought into everything that they were doing, even the fact that George Reeves transformed himself from Superman to Clark Kent simply by taking off his glasses. No attempt to change anything from his voice to his appearance.
Humans are so stupid.
They really are. Well, so I also never asked when I went back in the course of writing the book and was watching those same TV shows, it never struck me as odd that a gangster, and it was generally street thugs that George Reeves was fighting against, a gangster would fire all six bullets in his gun at George Reeves' Superman, and George Reeves wouldn't flinch. But when the frustrated gangster tossed the gun in his direction, he would duck. And I never asked why somebody who was bulletproof had to duck. It was our really wanting to believe. We believed that he was flying when all he was doing was jumping on a trampoline and being held in the air with fans blowing wind by him. Kids and even their parents, who were also watching it, so needed a hero that they could believe in that it didn't matter that it was bad TV. It was great dramatics for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the phones for a moment. We have Bobby in Lawrence. Bobby, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. Glad to be in touch with you. I'm a person who grew up with the comics. I was born in 35, And I've got in front of me the very first Superman, which was in 1939, I believe, in Detective Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if our experts realized that the first case Superman worked on was Who Killed Jack Kennedy?
Mm-hmm. Larry?
Yes. So not only do we realize that as great fans, the Kennedy Library in Boston, the John F. Kennedy Library, has, as of this past week, an exhibit on Jack Kennedy being involved with the comics. It wasn't just his namesake being there in that first issue of Superman. It was also Superman was involved in helping Jack Kennedy convince America that it had to get more physically fit. And they had a brilliant issue set to run right before Jack Kennedy was killed. And they had to pull the issue back at the last minute. But one of the first things LBJ did when he became president was tell them he wanted them to run that fitness comic book with Jack Kennedy in there with him. And it was really wonderful the way, again, you could bring the real world of our president with a contemporary issue like that in. I want to just say one more thing to your caller. If you've actually got in front of you that first issue, you can put your kids and your kids' kids through college with it if it's in good shape.
Bobby, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
And are you fabulously wealthy, or do you realize that you're fabulously wealthy now?
This was a reprint back from the 70s. I don't have the original. I did have it at one time, but it was disposed of with early Batman and all these other books that I had collected.
A tragedy. Bobby, thank you so much for your call.
Sure. Bye.
Bye. And we have Hugh here from Kansas City, Missouri. Hugh, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, great show. Huge Batman and Superman fan. The very first comic I ever bought with my own money was World's Finest Team-Up.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to move it up a little bit in the timeline and talk about after, in the Batman book, A Death in the Family, the Joker kills the second Robin and then runs off to hide in Iran and becomes the UN ambassador for the Iranian nation. That was back at the time when I was a kid reading that. That was huge. Iran was the big scary boogeyman in the room for my generation, and so I wanted to see if you guys had anything to say about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I know that Batman wasn't big into politics at that time, but that was a huge deal for comics and for fans.
Mm-hmm. Great question, Hugh. Michael, the scare of Iran and all the events from there.
Well, once again, it's the magic of comic books reflecting a changing America. And it is a mirror of our society. There's no question about that. The biggest change in Batman that was part of this and then led into even a bigger era came in 1986 with Frank Miller's groundbreaking graphic novel, which was the deconstruction of Batman, The Dark Knight Returns.
Mm-hmm.
And there you had a Batman portrayed well into his 50s, who didn't want to do it anymore, who was bitter but was forced to come out of retirement one more time for that battle to the death with the Joker. And it was a gritty and very adult interpretation of Batman. It opened the world of comic books to a general population around the world that were not particularly comic book readers, when they realized now this was being presented as sophisticated graphic storytelling, that this was appealing to older people, an older market, and it was a huge transition from comic books into graphic novels that was led by Batman. Mm-hmm. And now at this point, comics had even a bigger canvas to play with because they did not really any longer have to direct their storytelling and their themes to people who were either 8 to 12 or 16 to 22. They had the whole world before them.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned that they grew up and they had just – they had also been impacting more people. And I think we mentioned television earlier. And then, you know, they really moved into movies. And there was the Christopher Reeves Superman. And what the menaces that he was fighting in those first four films, how did we see the world playing out on the silver screen, particularly with our superhero Batman – Superman, excuse me.
So what we saw with Superman then, first of all, was that he could be played by a real actor who truly could make us believe that Superman could fly. Christopher Reeve did everything from change the part in his hair to lose about 2 inches of his height when he would slump when he was playing Clark Kent. And it was quite extraordinary in terms of having a really good actor for the first time playing him. And I think that's one of the reasons why he lasted for 4 movies, which these days is unheard of. I also think that he kept his enemies generally from the world of fantasy, and that was the kind of escape that people seemed to want. And it was characters like Lex Luthor, who I think was... Batman had really spectacular villains, but I think the best villain that Superman ever had was Lex Luthor, and it wasn't accidental that that was one of the villains that Christopher Reeve was battling. And he essentially created a really successful genre of superhero in the movies that Batman went on to best later on, but I think Christopher Reeve was really the king of the hill at that time.
Mm-hmm. And we have an email here from Alice in Overland Park. She sent this message. Did the original Superman intend to support women in the workplace by including the character Lois Lane?
So I think he did something quite brilliant by including Lois Lane that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster did. And I was, when my book first came out, I had the privilege of appearing in an event with Noelle Neal, the woman who played Lois Lane in that original George Reeve TV series for all but one of those years. And she described the way that in her later life, she had initially been trying to run away from the character that she had been stereotyped with as Lois Lane. But in her later life, she visited college campuses all across America. And people would come and tell her that she had been their inspiration to not just get involved in journalism, but to get involved in a professional life when, in an era in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, when there weren't a whole lot of role models for strong women. Mm-hmm. And you'll remember that Lois Lane wasn't just a reporter. She was a reporter that beat Clark Kent to just about every story that was out there. So she was a really great reporter.
Mm. And this kind of opens up the door to gender portrayal, particularly in comic books through time. I mean, as both supporting characters and as the superheroes themselves, how did that change, for example, like when Wonder Woman came on to the scene and those kind of things? Michael?
Well, it made absolute sense when Wonder Woman appeared in the early 1940s, the female version of Superman as she was originally intended. But she was created out of the passion and research of a well-known man, William Moulton Marston, who was one of the creators of the lie detector. And thus, her magic lasso that when she encircled you, you were forced to tell the truth. But she represented the highest ideals of women of womanhood. There were a number of women during that time period that were involved in the Wonder Woman stories. It was rooted in classical mythology, and it really gave readers, female readers in particular, a great heroine that they could identify with. So I think her presence was absolutely strong. In later decades, there was a waning interest in the female superheroes. Wonder Woman was really one of the very, very, very few that existed when superheroes began to go out of business in the 40s and 50s. But in more recent times, there has been a dramatic rebirth of female superheroes, and their popularity has been incredible. Many, many, many new characters, because, again, comics are reflecting the time. They are becoming as diverse as our population is. So whether it's more females, more people of color, Hispanic superheroes, gay, lesbian, transgender superheroes, everyone is becoming more and more a part of the current mythology in these superheroes. Even at Archie Comics, the first gay student at Riverdale High School now has his own comic book, Kevin Keller. So the times have been changing, not just specifically for women, but really for every representative group.
Mm-hmm. Larry, did you want to add to that?
No, I think that's true even in Superman. And Superman was the one who stayed away from those kinds of things for longer than just about anybody. They gave us the brilliant Lois Lane character at the very beginning, and it took them a whole lot of time to come up with other credible, creative, strong women characters.
Mm. And, you know, I also think about the argument about the objectification of women in comic books. For example, you know, we still see the Brokeback pose on, you know, even on film posters. And that's, you know, where it's almost always a woman is turned to the eye of the camera. And, you know, her back is exposed, but also she's contorted her torso in such a way that you can also see her chest. And she's usually looking over her shoulder. And, you know, it accentuates the female form. And, you know, it's kind of cartoonish and ridiculous. So how have comics kind of taken on this argument against their, you know, sensitivity and thoughtfulness about, you know, how to portray women, Michael?
Well, of course, at their root, comic books from day one dealt with a lot of pubescent male fantasy. And I'm happy to report that in many ways they are evolving and maturing. And one of the things that has been the spark to it has been the emergence of Japanese manga, Japanese comic books. And in many cases, those comic books are focused on young female protagonists. And for a long time, the American comic book industry had turned its back on its female readers as well as its youngest readers. And you could go into a Barnes & Noble after school on any particular day anywhere in America, and you would see racks of these Japanese manga graphic novels with young girls all over the place reading these things. And I think the success of those and the popularity of those had really was a significant factor in refocusing a lot of the American cartoonists, the American writers, on female figures that were not the stereotypical ones that we had seen in comics for so long.
Mm-hmm. And can you give me some examples of the contemporary where that's happening now?
In comic books?
In comic books today.
Oh, well, you know, if you start with someone like Kitty Pryde in the X-Men, is somebody I really think is a great example of that. Marvel has done a number of things with the New Mutants and Young Teams Runaways, where you are getting adventures that are focused more on what appear to be normal-looking teenagers, normal-looking college students, trying to get a sense of reality to it, something that young women can identify with. And as we found in the movies, largely, and as they're finding in the comics, the more you can get away from the traditional over-the-top, you know, kind of spandex look and try to make the characters feel more real, the more people attach to them and enjoy them.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, you worked on both the Tim Burton Batman films and the Christopher Nolan trilogy, and you know, which was a little bit more serious than the Tim Burton one. Even you know, took itself kind of a little bit more seriously. Why did Batman change between the '90s and Christopher Nolan's interpretation of it?
Well, I think if you look at what Tim did and what Christopher Nolan did, you can see number one, you had two geniuses at work, and they deserve all the accolades for what they accomplished. With Tim, in 1989, it was revolutionary. No one had ever shown a dark, serious comic book superhero before. And Tim's approach was that first he had to make everyone believe in Gotham City, because if they didn't believe in Gotham City, they would never be able to suspend their disbelief and believe a guy could get dressed up as a bat and fight a guy like the Joker in real life. And his insight was this is all really about Bruce Wayne, not Batman, and that he had to convince the world, which he did, I believe, through Michael Keaton's portrayal, that Bruce Wayne was obsessed, driven to the point of being perhaps psychotic, to the point where audiences said, yes, that is a guy who would get dressed up as a bat and go out and do this. With Christopher Nolan, some 15 to 20 years later, Chris came at it to restore the darkness and dignity to Batman and said, I want to convince everybody this is real. He had to convince us that we could believe that there could be a guy like Bruce Wayne today on a Lost Horizon-like journey of self-discovery, that the Joker could be real today, a homicidal maniac, a modern-day terrorist who places no value on human life, that Gotham City could be a real city in this gray world we live in of order versus chaos, and did a spectacular, amazing job at that. And what I felt was elevating the comic book movie to the point where you walk out of one of Chris's movies and you can say that was a great film.
And so, Larry, I kind of want to know this because I sometimes have a hard time like believing in Superman fully because he's so otherworldly. So like help sell me on Superman. Why is he so like, why do you love him so much? Why do you write books about him?
Sure. I think that the reason Superman has lasted 75 years and will hopefully last another 75 is partly what we talked about earlier, that he has evolved more than the fruit fly over the last 75 years, giving us a hero who always seemed like he was for our times. The other half, which seems like a contradiction, mm-hmm. is the way he never changed. He was always the hero. We had dark heroes like Batman. We had fraught heroes like Spider-Man. Superman was the clunky and familiar hero who knew right from wrong instinctively and always did right. And I think that's something we keep coming back to. And I'm hoping that Michael, who I think rescued Batman on the screen with his great films, is going to do the same thing for the Superman franchise when he comes out with this next Superman-Batman film, because he needs somebody brilliant like Michael to pull him out of the problems that I think he got into with the Man of Steel movie last summer.
And just one final question here before we go to break. In the movie, the most recent one, Superman is a Royals fan. It totally makes sense for the Man of Steel. But is it true? Is Superman a Royals fan?
That was the first that I had heard of it. Actually, as a Boston partisan, I thought he was always a Red Sox fan. But.
Well, we'll have to find out in the next film. Larry Tye, he's the author of Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Heroes. He speaks today at the Jewish Community Center and the Kansas City Central Library. So thank you so much, Larry, for joining us.
Thanks.
And then Michael Uslan, he's the executive producer of the Batman franchise. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks a lot.
And you can find more information about all of our broadcasts at KCUR.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, join us for a regional religion roundtable as we look at how some objects are sacred in different ways depending on your faith. The show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Bette Lithoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Matthew Law Milton, and you are up to date.